This audio recording is under copyright protection, all rights reserved. Any duplication, transmission, or broadcast without permission is strictly prohibited by U.S. and international laws.
Here we see the initial time of the control group, 597, the classical group, 590, and the hard group rock, 569. So actually, the group that was going to get the anthrax started out with a slightly higher average speed than the other two groups. So they had a little bit of advantage of being somewhat mentally gifted to begin with. After 1 week of listening, you see that the control group speeded up through their maze a little bit, 437. Now, why would they get better? Well, they'd run the maze once already, and they were getting older. And most of us are getting smarter as we're getting older, up to a certain point. All right, the classical group did not improve as much as the control group after 1 week of the classical music. They were about in the same range, even a little slower. So the benefits of the classical music were not yet to be seen. The hard rock group, the anthrax group, look at this. 900 seconds. Now, how many minutes is that? About 15 minutes to run a maze, which 1 week ago they could do in 10 minutes. Well, it just gets worse from here. Week two, the control group, 349 seconds. Okay, they're getting older, smarter. They run the maze three times now. The classical group now, the effects of that music really starting to kick in. 188 seconds. How many minutes is that? 3 minutes. They're running a 10-minute maze in 3 minutes. They're cooking. Sadly, the anthrax group, 1,264 seconds. How many minutes is that? 21 minutes to run the maze they previously could do in 10. They're getting stupider fast. Last test, at the end of the experiment, after the third week, control group, 307, the classical group, 100 seconds, a little over a minute and a half to run the maze, and the hard rock group, look at this, 1,824 seconds. How many minutes is that? Half an hour. It was taking them half an hour to find their way out of this little maze that they used to be able to get out of in 10 seconds. 10 minutes, excuse me. Thank you. So, that's very interesting. Now, David Merrill won the Virginia State Science Fair with this experiment, and it is extremely well documented. The information which he sent me was of a very high scientific caliber. But as I was talking with him, he explained to me that he also did two other similar experiments, one before and one after this. And I said, well, tell me about them. And he said, well, the one that I did before totally failed because I kept the mice in communal cages, and the mice listening to the anthrax began to attack and kill each other. And so he couldn't continue the experiment. Same problem Dr. Bird had with the voodoo drum beats, that they became so highly aggressive that they couldn't even live in the same cage without killing each other. Highly abnormal behavior for mice. So he had to scrap the whole thing and start all over again with new mice and build little individual cages for 30 mice. Can you imagine? This guy was committed. But he did another experiment the year after because he took a lot of flack. People said, well, you know, anthrax. I never listened to anthrax. You know, only idiots would listen to that. I listened to the Beatles, you know, or whatever. So he thought it might be a wise idea to try and compare some of the other types of music that people listen to. And so he replicated his experiment one more time with three groups of mice. He did everything as precisely the same as he could before in terms of space, temperature, food, everything. But this time he had one group listening to CD called Hits of the 50s, right? Another CD called Hits of the 70s, and another CD called Hits of the 90s, right? So he's hitting all the generations, right? So when he compared the initial run times, these are the initial times of the group. So now this is the two experiments put together on one chart. You see that the control group, classic group, 50s group were right at 600 seconds, right at the 10-minute mark for the 10-minute maze. The 70s group started out a little higher. The group that was going to get the 90s music started out a little higher, and the anthrax group started out a little lower. So those were the initial times. Then he started to track their progress. And here is the chart which he tracked their progress. Now you might be interested just to hear a little bit of the music that he used. So I'm going to play, while you're looking and thinking about this chart, some Mozart. It perhaps will help your perception of it. And I'm going to listen to a little bit of the Mozart Violin Concerto in A major. You have to follow this. You have to use your mind to listen to it. There you see. You see that the Mozart group was indeed the highest, right? And they quickly improved their score by 2 weeks of listening. So get at least 2 weeks under your belt before the SAT. The next group down is the green mark. And it's sad to point out, but that green line is the control group, the group with no music at all. Which means that these other groups, although they did improve over their original time, did not improve as much as if they hadn't had any music at all. Because you see, the next one down is the music of the 70s. That may be good news for some of us. Below that, we see then the group performing music of the 50s. And here, the music of the 90s, about 1,100 seconds there. And then, of course, we know about the anthrax group. You're probably, some of you haven't heard anthrax, and you're dying to know what it sounds like. So I'm going to play for you a short excerpt from the piece called Fueled on the album Stomp 445. That's enough, isn't it? Now, I would ask you, what is the dominant factor in that music? What's the dominant component? What do you hear more than anything else? The beat, the loud rhythm, right? And Dorothy Retallick, who did the experiments with plants, did some very interesting experiments comparing, say, one piece recorded with string music and that same folk tune recorded with steel drums. And she found that the plants did not respond positively to the highly percussive version, but they did respond positively to the more melodic version. There's something about the rhythm which is very, very powerful in how it affects living things. And one of the other things that we learned from the ancient Greeks, really, is that there are three basic components of music, and they relate to the human being in a very logical and clear way. To have music, you've got to have melody, you've got to have harmony, and you've got to have rhythm. Those are the three components. Without all three of those, you really can't have any music at all. So the Greeks saw clearly that melody is connected with the mind or the intellect. It stimulates thinking. Harmony, of course, connects with the heart, the emotions, the feeling body. And then, of course, rhythm would connect with what? The physical body. And so the Greeks actually had laws about music. It was illegal to write or perform music in which the rhythm was dominant over the melody. Why? Because in the Greek philosophy, the mind had to govern both the heart and the body. Because a heart not governed by the mind could make some very bad choices. The body, ungoverned by the mind, could get into big trouble. And so, in the ideal circumstance, the mind would govern the heart and the body. Consequently, music, being representative of the human being, the melody should be, in their system, dominant over the harmony or the rhythm. Does that make sense? So they actually had laws about music, and they were very specific on it. But there's something that we see happening in the world today with our music, and that is that the rhythmic component has become dominant in almost all popular music. Now, is rhythmic dominant music bad? No. It's very important. In fact, where do you hear a lot of rhythmic dominant music? Marches, right? Bum, 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 right? Let's get up and go. Let's march into war. Let's fight for the right, right? So you can really get energized to fight or even clean your house with rhythmically dominant music, right? So it is not intrinsically bad per se. however, what we hear is so much rhythmically dominant music that we are becoming hyperstimulated in our physical bodies. And that's not a particularly great thing, especially when you are a very rapidly growing young man or woman who's dealing with the complexities of a rapidly growing physical body and the hormones associated with that. So what you're doing with having popular music which is rhythmically dominant is you're hyperstimulating the entire society physically. You can test music by simply scanning the channels on your radio in your car as you're driving. You hear something, turn down the volume as low as you can and still hear something. And whatever you hear, that's the dominant thing. If you hear a harmony, then that's harmony dominant. If you hear the beat of it, then that's rhythmic dominance. And if you hear a melody, then that's harmonic dominance, so, or melodic dominance. So it's very easy to evaluate music that way. And I am not at all opposed to rhythmic dominant music in its basic form. There's one other thing which has occurred that is really an aberration in the history of the world, in the history of music, and that is rhythmic patterns are now changed into what we would call a syncopated form. Now, most of you who are musicians have heard of syncopation, I would guess. That's when the notes, the accent, goes on the offbeat, right? And a lot of composers, all the way back to Bach and Vivaldi, used syncopation to draw attention to a spot. It kind of creates a little tension. That's a Mozart violin concerto, you see. And what it does is it creates a moment of tension, right? And then it resolves into a da 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 da, right? A normal pattern. But what we're hearing in most popular music today is a persistent syncopation, a syncopation that does not go away for the entire duration of the piece. So the words are going one way, the melody's going one way, but the rhythm is going the other way. This creates a tension in the music. It also creates a tension in the body, because it is inimical to the natural rhythmic patterns of the body, which are rhythmic. You have two rhythms in your body. You have a heartbeat, which beats in triple meter, right? Bum, 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 bum. One, two, three. One, two, three. One, two, three. Right? And you have a pulse, which beats in duple meter. One, two, one, two. And all music is either duple or triple meter by its basis. If you put them together, you get 6/8 time, right? But you've got your marches, right? Bum, 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 bum. One, two, one, two, one, two, da, da, da. That's duple, right? Or 4/4. And you've got your waltzes. Da, 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 dum, bum, 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 bum. One, two, three, one, two, bum, 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 bum. Like that. So you've got these two things going on. Now, if you pervert the rhythm and reverse the accent, it does some very interesting things to your body. I would like you to hear some syncopated rhythm so you know exactly what I'm talking about. And then I will juxtapose that with some non-syncopated rhythm. First of all, this is a song by Joan Osborne called Saint Teresa. Now you hear a normal rhythm. Here it's going off. Like that. Now you hear the melody is with the rhythm, but the dominant beat is off the rhythm. And it's persisting through the entire duration of the song.
Sit down in the corner, just a
so that shows you how that syncopation works to put the strongest beat off the downbeat according to the melody. Does that make sense? All right, that would be very syncopated. Now here would be some music which is not at all syncopated. This is The Rolling Deep from an album called The Tree of Life by some Appalachian musicians Coulter and Phillips. You hear the bass beat. Kind of energizing music. You could dance to that, you could clean your house, you could jog, and it would get you going. It has a good effect there, and you can see that the rhythm is right in line with the melody. Does that make sense? So now you know what I'm talking about when I say syncopation, when the offbeat, right, is stronger than the normal beat. Syncopation is not bad by its nature. Like I said, Bach and Vivaldi and Beethoven all use syncopation, but how do they use it? As a spice, right? To create a moment of excitement and then a resolution. Like giving it a little oomph. Whereas the dominant would be like eating straight salt. Constant spice. So, that's the case. Now, this thing about the human body, it's very interesting because we have a very sophisticated system of hormones and neurotransmitters and endorphins to help us deal with stress, right? Some of you who are older probably are familiar with those words, but basically you have certain chemicals that are released into your brain to help you deal with difficult or stressful situations. For example, you hear of a story of, something falls, a huge bookshelf falls on the kid's dad and the kid gets this incredible burst of strength and lifts the bookshelf, which is not something he ever could have done with his own muscle had it not been for this incredible release of adrenaline that gave him a momentary superhuman strength, right? Or you're driving along and you see lights flashing behind you and you have a little moment where you check your speedometer and you feel a physiological change in your body. Your heart's beating just a little bit faster. There's a little bit of adrenaline there, and then when the policeman passes by, then that effect leaves, right? Some people really crave this type of feeling. They go bungee jumping, right? Because they like that particular, that feeling of adrenaline rush. Also, there's endorphins. Endorphins are what helps to numb you to pain. For example, if in a war or in a horrible accident, right, the pain normally would be just unbearable and you couldn't function because it would be so horrible. But your brain releases quickly endorphins, which are like morphine, essentially, and they counteract the pain in your brain so that you can continue to function, right? So we have a very sophisticated balance of chemicals going on in our body all the time. Now, some people make an argument, and I think it's very well documented, that certain types of music are very addictive, that there are kids who are unhappy unless they can hear certain types of music, that they get nervous and anxious. And there's actually a guy, John Diamond, Dr. John Diamond, who did a whole research on that very thing, the addiction of music and the physiological response when it's taken away. Why, though? Why would music cause an addiction which in many ways resembles, say, a chemical addiction? Well, I think you may see where I'm going with this. When you have a body that beats according to a normal rhythm, 1, 2, 1, 2, your pulse is going 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, your heart is going 1, 2, right? And you subject on that physical body a rhythm which is syncopated. Your body actually feels under attack because it's trying to retain its rhythmic integrity against a rhythm that is opposite its normal condition. Do you see? When your body is under attack, what happens? You get the release of endorphins, and you get the release of adrenaline, and you get chemicals flooding into your system to defend you, to help you be strong, to handle that attack, right? Now, what if the attack doesn't go away? Then the body continues to release the chemicals and endorphins until it can no longer do it. And then it quickly shuts down and has to reproduce more of those. And then the attack comes and it releases them again and it becomes a cyclical and an addictive behavior. I actually realized that I am addicted to hot peppers. And I wasn't quite sure. You see, I eat very hot peppers. I like got for Christmas, you know, a bottle of Dave's Insanity. My wife, however, cannot stand hot peppers at all. And she's always mystified by why I like that painful, burning sensation. You know, if my eyes aren't watering, it's not enough. Right? Why? I go to the Thai food, eat 8 on the scale of 10. Because I think I get this hormonal adrenaline endorphin thing going, right? It hurts, so my body releases endorphins, which chemically is almost exactly the same as morphine, right? And then the pain of the peppers wears off, but the endorphin feeling remains. I think that's the case. Now, fortunately, I do not eat hot peppers 3 meals a day, 7 days a week. I would eat some hot peppers maybe a couple times a week. And now that I know what's going on, I'm thinking about cutting back on these hot peppers. Because I didn't realize this till recently. But the kids who are listening to the music are sometimes needing to listen how much? Hours and more hours every day, every day. And I won't even terrorize you with the statistics of what the average kid listens to. But it is a phenomenal amount of music, which we know, because it's popular music, is primarily rhythmic dominant, focused on stimulating their bodies, and primarily syncopated to attack that body in that way. I would like to show you, though, a couple more things. I've got some listening samples. Now, I want to be perfectly clear here. My purpose in presenting this information is not to be confrontational, nor is it to say, you know, this is good, that's bad. If you like this, you're good. And if you like that, you're bad. I am not judging anyone. What I am trying to do with these listening samples is I'm trying to help you learn how to listen a little more objectively. Do you remember when I said at the beginning, we live in a world that is auditorily uncontrolled? You really don't have any control over what you hear unless you go in the restaurant like I do and say, if you'll change this music, I will stay and spend $50. If you don't, I will have to leave. I've done that only because I want to have a nice dinner. But we very seldom have much control over the music. So it's extremely important that we listen in a more discriminating way. I'm trying to train my children, and I think you should train your children to be able to analyze the music by the components. Is this harmony dominant? Is it rhythm dominant? Is it melody dominant? Is it a normal beat? Is it a syncopated beat? What are the things that you need to know in order to hear something and know what you're hearing? That's what I'm trying to do. Now, I'm going to pick on a few different pieces and artists that some of you may be familiar with, and I am not saying here that anything is particularly good or bad, but I want you to listen more objectively. I want you to tell me what you hear. Now, this one is Michael W. Smith. Some of you, how many people familiar with Michael W. Smith? And I just want you to listen, given the facts that I've stated and the explanation that I've given, what do you hear with this particular music? This is Love Me Good. So you hear a very long intro, which clearly has what?
Rhythm.
A dominant rhythm, a syncopated beat, and it doesn't go away even after the words start. It remains present. It's less dominant because the words are loud enough that you can hear them, but it's still constantly there. And so it's creating attention, maintaining that particular attention. Now, let us contrast that with a similar type of current Christian musician who is using the opposite effect, a rhythm to support the music that he is trying to say. This is John Michael Talbot, Glory and Praise. A very strong rhythmic pattern. The drum is there.
Glory and praise to our God, who alone gives life to our day.
It's very physical. When you want to tap your foot, you want to move, but it's not creating the same tension. And you can focus on the words, so you're not distracted by the rhythm.
Glory and praise to our God, who alone.
You can sing that much more easily, and you can think about your words. You can actually worship with that song, I think, more easily than when you're kind of trying to fight off the rhythmic attack in the other way. Another case, John Michael Talbot is an interesting musician. He's probably one of the finest musicians alive today from what he does, but he does do some very odd things. Not all of it I like. This next piece is very complicated, and I want you to listen to it because he goes in and out and in and out, and he's got a syncopated and a non-syncopated rhythm going on at the same time, which are like fighting, and then he resolves it at the end of the introduction. See what you hear on this one. This is from We Are One Body. Basic beat, and then the syncopated little ones in between. It's creating kind of a kind of chaos feeling almost. And then you feel, it's going to resolve. If it didn't, you'd be stressed.
We are one body, one body in Christ.
And there you have then the resolution of it. So that creating of a little bit of tension can be very effective. And so part of the types of rhythms and instruments that we would normally associate with, say, rock music, are actually can be very useful to create a very sophisticated pattern. Amy Grant, many of you are familiar with Amy Grant. She runs the spectrum of music. Listen to this and tell me what you hear. This is kind of getting into a persistent syncopation. Still, the song is very dominant. Boom, 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 boom. It's very effective. It engages you immediately. And she sings her song, and that goes on in the background the whole time. So it creates kind of a comfortable feeling. And I would say, you know, that's kind of an easy one to listen to. This next one, that was Everywhere I Go. And the next one also by Amy Grant is I'm Gonna Fly. Now this one, you can see how she's taken that, speeded it up, and gone to a whole different level of rhythmic power. Hear how it's much different. Your body is going boom, boom, and it's going. It's very easy. It's very easy to get used to that. It's very easy to kind of become immune to it, especially if, like me, you grew up in the 70s and you listened to all sorts of kinds of music, and you live in the world today where you're constantly bombarded with it. It's a little bit, the syncopated rhythmic dominant music is a little bit like air pollution, right? If you live in a big city, you know there's air pollution. You know it's not good for you, but there's nothing you can do about it, so you basically just forget that it's there. Some days it gets worse, some days it's not. There's a music pollution going on. And so it's very, very difficult to not become comfortable with that. But it keeps going in this direction. If you listen to people like Rebecca St. James, this is a song entitled Pray. And I'm not quite sure because it doesn't really make me want to pray, although perhaps I'm thinking I should pray for Miss St. James. Rhythmic dominant, it's got disharmony as well. Also, you notice that popular music is similar to the Philip Glass style, has a very narrow range of melody. And that's really normal for popular music. In fact, before we had, quote, popular music, we had folk music, right? Which was very narrow melodic range, usually within one octave, right? So everybody could sing it, since most people don't sing outside of one octave very efficiently. Folk music and popular music is narrow in its range, so you can sing along. But, you know, when you listen to musicians like that, you wonder, though, how narrow can it get? Do they know actually more than four notes? Because it's very, very non-complex melodically. Now, this one I just had to include for you because, to me, it is the epitome of an oxymoronic song. You know what an oxymoron is? Something that cannot possibly be true. Like giant shrimp, right? Or military intelligence, right? Well, I'm just using the cliche ones. This song is called The Devil Is Bad by the W's, right? And I just want you to listen to this and tell me, after you hear it, what does it make you feel like? The title is The Devil Is Bad. Got a long, suck you in introduction here. Tijuana Brass style. Are you ready? It's gonna happen now. What does it make you want to do? Yeah, it makes you want to dance, doesn't it? Let's go!
So I was walking in the garden one day when a snake slipped around her feet.
You gotta listen really hard here.
Follow me over to this tree and I'll give you something good to eat. Why don't
I... And I skipped in the song. I thought, well, this is really interesting because it's easy to listen to. It makes you want to dance. And it's all about how the devil is bad. Where do we normally dance traditionally over time? Weddings, celebrations, right? We're now going to celebrate this fact that the devil is bad. Are you ready for the chorus? Here it comes.
Devil and the devil is bad. Hey! You are the devil and the devil is bad. Hey! You are the devil and the devil is bad. Hey! You are the devil and you are bad.
I love it. It's so ridiculous because why would you want to be celebrating this fact or singing out to the world with great joy about Lucifer? I don't get it. Now, I bought this CD that this was on at the bookstore at my daughter's Christian college, right? And I played this for her and I said, well, now what do you think of this, Jen? And she goes, oh, it's a great song. They play it in the dormitory all the time. And I said, oh, well, what do you think? She goes, well, the devil is bad. Do you get the disconnect there? Anyway, I thought someone who really knows what the afterlife holds, Mozart, the Requiem, Confutatus. If you watch the movie Amadeus, you remember well the scene here. Yes. Now that's music to reform a soul, right? However, I would like to just play a few more things because my personal experience with music is that I made a mistake. I made a big parenting mistake. And it's probably, if I could go back in time and change one thing that I've done in my entire life, I would probably go back and change the parenting mistake that I made with my oldest daughter when she was 14. Because when she was 14, she was becoming more independent and she had some friends and we lived in a small town. And one of my friends ran the Christian bookstore in town and she started going over to help out, you know, talking to the college students and the high school kids who would gravitate in, and they had a little espresso bar. And of course, the type of music that they were playing in this Christian coffee shop was exactly some of what I've been playing for you. And she brought home some CD of the Newsboys. And I listened to it and I said, this is really hard for me to deal with. And so I made a rule, which is what dads are supposed to do, right? I said, here's the rule. If I ever hear this in the house, I will confiscate it and destroy it immediately. Right? So, I'm not going to tell you what you can or can't do as long as no one else in this entire house has to suffer for your decision. Right? Wrong choice. Because what happened was she moved ever so slightly in her musical taste to the point where there was really no difference whatsoever between the Newsboys and the Smashing Pumpkins. And if you know anything about the Smashing Pumpkins, melancholy and the infinite sadness, it's really depressing stuff. The lyrics are quite morbid and degrading. But really, once you get used to the Newsboys, and it's so easy to get used to it, when you have these nice, smooth little introductions, make you feel happy and comfortable, kind of open yourself up, and then gradually it hits you. And it's pretty strong. It's almost a constant push. If you got to a point where you liked listening to that, that's the Newsboys entertaining angels, I doubt it, you would really have no problem listening to this. This is Muzzle from the Melancholy and Infinite Sadness by the Smashing Pumpkins. The only way you could know the words is if you read them. But the brain may be able to hear them, the repetition of it again and again. You may be able to pick up the messages. And I hated to do it, but I just have to keep going the logical progression here. This is more Smashing Pumpkins. Zero. Now that actually starts to sound almost satanic. Doesn't it? That epitomizes the worst of everything I've talked about, right? It's got the repetitive to insanity. It's got the non-melody. It's got the dominant rhythm. And there's something just that strikes you as particularly evil in the intent as well. Whereas some of the other ones didn't have that intent behind them. But no, the worst thing I ever heard was the one on the CD I bought that was Wow. I don't know if you've seen that, the Wow Christian musician hits of the 1999 or something. I bought this at my daughter's Christian university. This is a group called Living Sacrifice, a Christian metal group. Now, I'm going to play it. You can fold your arms if you need to. When you hear it, though, I want you to think back to the anthrax that we started with and the mice. This piece is called Threatened. Notice how easy it is to get started. Kind of interesting, actually. You wonder what's going to happen. That's kind of a literary quality. Kind of sucks you in like the introduction to a good story. But what's really interesting is that it's not really a huge step to that. It's a lot of little steps. And so I don't tell people, this is good, this is bad. What I'm trying to have you hear is what you're hearing. I want you to hear what you're hearing. I want you to listen to what you're hearing. I want you to teach your children to do the same. Because a heart that loves God and a mind that understands are very powerful when combined to help you do what you need to do in your life. We need a little bit of healing, I think. So experience the healing power of Gabriel Fauré in paradise from his Requiem. Close your eyes. Interesting, because you hear repetition, don't you? You do hear repeating patterns. And it's very interesting to look at it also philosophically and even theologically. You really can't pick up a Bible and find anywhere in there that proves certain music could be harmful or ungodly. You really can't, because we don't know what music they're talking about 2,000, 4,000 years ago, right? So there's no exegetical way to convince people of the fact. But we do know God in other ways as well. We know God from His creation. We know God from nature. We see the stars in the sky. We feel God's hand in that creation. We see the trees. We see the leaves, the snowflakes, the faces of our friends. We see a particular quality of God's creation which has to do with repetition, right? Because if you see a row of poplar trees and you say, oh, that's beautiful, they all look pretty much the same because they are all poplar trees. You look around the room and you see 100 human faces and they all look pretty much the same because we're all humans. And if you look at snowflakes, they all have the same basic things going on. But what is so remarkable about God's creation is that every single repeated pattern in the universe is different. When you see the row of poplar trees, they're all slightly different. They have just different shapes and branches. And if you looked at every individual leaf on that tree, it would be a little bit different. If you looked at every snowflake that ever fell, each one, although it had the same structure, would be just a little bit different. You see, the nature of creation is variety within structure. Variety within structure is how God is in our physical world. Now, what happens when you separate variety and structure? What happens when you take the structure away and you have only variety? What remains? Chaos. This is representative in, say, modern art, you know, Picasso, or let's throw the paint on the canvas. See what happens and call it art, right? Schoenberg, 12-tone music, some of the worst kinds of jazz that jump all over so unpredictably. It's variety without structure. And most human beings find that so intolerable that it really doesn't become terribly popular or propagate itself too much. What happens when you take away the variety and you're left with only the structure? You're left with monotony. You're left with mechanized creation, right? You're left with a row of townhouses. Have you ever driven by I got on the freeway, you're driving by, and you see 18 houses that look exactly the same. There's no landscaping in. And you kind of think, ugh, I wouldn't want to live there. Do you ever have that feeling? Or imagine a whole row of artificial Christmas trees that had exactly the same shape down to the last detail. It would make you sick to see it. Why? Because both of those extremes are inimical to God's being. And we are God's creation. And we are the body of God on earth, body of Christ. And when we allow things into our world that are inimical to who God made us to be, that's a very bad thing. It hurts, it harms our soul, it harms the way that we can serve Him. And a lot of this music is going to that extreme. It's giving you the structure without the variety. From the Philip Glass to the Living Sacrifice, you've got a spectrum there. Whereas when you have the variety within the structure, it reflects God's nature. It brings you joy. And I'm going to play just a little bit here of Coulter and Phillips, and you'll know the tune. It's one that God Himself wrote, I think. So, I don't come out saying this is good, that is bad. What I want to do is help you learn to listen. And I'd like to make just a few short, final observations. And this is where I'm stretching beyond simple observation or research. I'm going to make some statements that I've been thinking about for a long time, and I'd like you to think about them too. We live in a country which 100 to 200 years ago you could have called a distinctly Christian country. Most people considered themselves Christians or followers of Christ in one way, and most people, whether they attended church or not, held Christian values. Would you not agree? We used to have a country like that. Now we live in a country which clearly has a majority of people that are distinctly anti-Christian. They do not hold Christian values, nor would they claim to be followers of Christ. Would you agree? So, what have we got here? A big change in a relatively short period of time. And I would ask you to look back and say, when did the change occur? When did it start? When did we go from becoming a distinctly Christian culture toward a distinctly non-Christian culture? Give me a date. 50s, 60s? Probably. But it started to show up very obviously in the 50s, 60s. And what changed in the world in the 50s and 60s? Television was a big factor. Also, the music changed very significantly. The advent of recorded music, the type of music. And I would propose to you that music has a far more powerful effect than anyone in this room thinks, even myself. I showed you how it can change the brain. how you can make your kids and help them become the best that they can be through the power of music. That same power, applied in a different way, I believe has the power to undermine the soul, to actually strip away the spiritual sensitivity. Even with television, why is it that people didn't say, that's wrong? What was it that caused us to give up and stop saying, that's wrong? Or in another generation later, not even to know that it was wrong, and now to think that it's something to be embraced. The music has a phenomenal power. We say that it's the language of the soul, right? We say that. What does it mean? If you were the evil one and you wanted to wipe out a culture, where would you attack? How would you attack? You'd attack in a way that would get to every single person in the most subtle and indetectable way ever. So I would actually pin the musical shift in the world very clearly to the decrease of spiritual sensitivity of the Christians in this country. Now, you can agree with that or not, but I'm going to go one step further. And I'm going to say this. What is happening in the body of remaining Christians in the world today? What is the gross revenue of a Christian bookstore? 85% of the gross revenue of a Christian bookstore. CDs. They're not selling books anymore, they're selling music. What are they selling? Well, you can go check it out. I would suggest that what happened to America is happening right now in the churches across the country. That there's an infiltration, there's a shift, and the result of the shift is going to be the wiping out of the spiritual sensitivity that allows Christians to still come apart and be a separate people. So, it's a big jump, and I've gone on for a long time, and those of you who are young have done extremely well to sit here and listen to that, and I am very, very grateful. And I have a handout provided for you which has some of the diagrams and charts and a list of all the research that was done, as well as a list of the pieces of music that I played. And we've got those in the back of the room. If you'd like to have one, you're welcome to. And I should just finish with one more piece. And if you want to get up while it's going on, you certainly may. If you have any questions, don't hesitate to stay and talk to me after. Recommend this book, Crisis in Christian Music. It's written by a musician, so it's an educational book, not an inflammatory one. And the place you could order it is on the handout I gave you. I don't sell it, but I do recommend it. Crisis in Christian Music.
Thanks for listening. Do you have questions or comments? Please contact the Institute for Excellence in Writing at 1-800-856-5815 or visit our website, iew.com.